Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. This series focuses on hidden elements that have influenced Wabanaki history from the invasion of our shores in the 18th century to the land claims and beyond. Today, we continue our discussion about the hidden element of blood quantum and the influence it has played in the development of tribal communities, membership numbers, and our very identities. This is a highly controversial subject. We realize there are no easy answers. My guests today are Professors Harold Prince, Professor of Anthropology Emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Darren Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation, and Professor of Anthropology and Chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Our special guest today is Morgan Talte. He's a member of the Penobscot Nation and an award-winning author of Night of the Living Res and his latest book, Fire Exit. Morgan is currently teaching creative writing at the University of Maine. Welcome to the show. Harold, we missed your input last time, so let's hear your take on the blood quantum and its origins. And I think you can tell us a little bit more about the origin or the European origin of this term.
Good morning or afternoon. I'm not sure when this show is going to be broadcast. I think it's afternoon, so it's a good afternoon. Both Donna and Darren, of course, Morgan. It's a pleasure to join you three for this particular session. I was at Mount Kineo with my Dutch nephew and his two kids and had a great time. But as a result, I missed the first show with Morgan. I had just heard it, though, and I enjoyed listening to the three of you deconstructing the concept of blood quantum and the difficulties that term presents in terms of identity as well as status, rights, and what it means in terms of community and what it means to be exiled from the community by bureaucratic rules, in this case, the rules that are set by the state of Maine and its government agents historically, and that now, and I think that all of you commented on that, was the issue of the internalization of colonization, whereby the tribe itself, the Penobscot Indian Nation, has exercised power by means of blood quantum in terms of who will be allowed to be in the community and who will not be allowed in. And I was I'm jumping a little bit ahead here because I know that Morgan's book actually in a story form in essence teases out the complexities of what it means to be in or being out. And he has a metaphor here of the Penobscot River that's both metaphor and reality, that to be on the island or off the island, on the reservation, off the reservation, et cetera, et cetera. And it has wonderful kinship structures built around it in order to make his point with stepfathers on both sides and so on and so forth. And so Darren earlier mentioned that he himself had relatives in the Ranko family who had been dismembered, in essence, cut from the tribe based on blood quantum application and were no longer entitled. And we've seen that in the history of the Penobscot Nation that repeatedly people have been ousted from the island for complex reasons, including sometimes people who are full-blood Indian. I'm thinking here about Charles Shea's sister-in-law, the wife of Pache. After Pache died, she was a Mi'kmaq from Nova Scotia, a survivor of Shubenacadie, but she was forced out by the family, backed up by the tribe, when Pat Shea had died, and she was a Mi'kmaq, had a son, a Mi'kmaq son, and there was a whole complicated issue about it. So in other words, the blood quantum thing is complicated, and Donna just asked something about the background of it. And if you break the term up, right, quantum is, as the term says, it says the quantity, the amount of blood that you have. Blood itself is a complicated concept Historically, in many cultures, blood refers to the life force. That's why when you see sacrifices, it often involves blood, the smearing of blood. So blood has a strong potency, a cultural potency in terms of the association with the sacred, but also, therefore, with the fear of pollution. The blood can be polluted. So the contamination of blood is something that people have been concerned about, just like contamination of anything that's deemed to be pure. And so because the blood is associated with the life force, it's also by extension the issue of the life force that keeps the community alive. And hence you get all these rules about incest, for example, whereby the bloodline is threatened by marrying in or having a sexual relationship too close with close relatives, or to have marriage prohibitions that you cannot marry certain people outside of the community who don't share that same blood. So you see that historically with the aristocracy in Europe, where you see what we anthropologists refer to as endogamy, marrying in other words, you are only allowed to marry inside that group, however that group has been defined and where the boundaries are set. The Jewish nation, historically, the Hebrew nation, had very strict rules about who was considered to be a Jew, and it was not determined by their father's status, but exclusively through the mother's status. And today we see that in the state of Israel applies that rule in terms of if you have a man or a woman whose father was Jewish and was raised as Jew, but her mother was not, and she cannot demonstrate it, that person does not have the right to return. It's basically considered to be a foreigner, has to go through a lot of other hoops. Whereas a person who has a mother who is Jewish, almost automatically are entitled to Israeli citizenship. So I can go across the world with examples of this, but I'd like to briefly pause with the conquest of the Western Hemisphere by European nations, because here we're talking about the Americas, but not just about New England or Maine as part of New England, but also with respect to the Wabanaki nations that historically dealt with both the French as well as the English. And therefore, what were the French concepts about miscegenation, mixed marriages, for example, as opposed to the English? And then the English, you have to divide between the Protestant English and the Catholic English. And that you can see when you go down farther south to where Roman Catholic Scots, for example, came in. And then you go even further south toward what's now Florida and Louisiana. That's, of course, historically claimed by the Spaniards. And the Spanish had a completely different set of rules once again. So if you zoom in on the Spanish notion of how the Spaniards organized the territories that they colonized and realized there was a miscegenation going on between the early Spaniards, few of whom came with wives or daughters, they intermarried with indigenous people, but they also brought slaves, the imported slaves. What you then get is a colonial society that becomes very complicated because of sexual relationships that are not controlled by the state, but by incidents, accidents, love relationships, whatever it may be. So when the Spaniards, in the course of the mid-16th century, 1500s, when they colonized the homeland of the Aztec, the Maya, and the Inca, and all the other indigenous nations and kingdoms and empires and tribes, and brought in as a replacement of indigenous labor, black slaves from Africa, what you then got was a miscegenation in the population, and they began to impose a social order that really began to take shape in the course of the 17th century and got as many differentials as 16 different categories by name, and all in a kind of a hierarchy with black slaves at the bottom, white Europeans at the top. Second rate was the whites of European descent born in the Americas. And then you got all the mixing of the mestizos, right? The people who are mixed Native American white, the mixing of with blacks, the mulatto, right, with black. Then you get the people who are mulatto intermarrying with white, mestizo intermarrying with white, whether it's a mother or a father. Anyway, ultimately you get 16 categories of the casta system. It's called the casta system. The term casta itself is derived from the Latin term for pure. The term incest is not pure. So the term incest, if you look at the derivation of that term, that's what it means. So the Europeans were not the only ones who had that kind of system in terms of separating groups in closed classes, if you will, in a hierarchical system. The Hindus, of course, have the two, right? So you have the caste system, and the casta term here was introduced by the Portuguese, but it was an indigenous term in India that was called the Jat. And each Jat caste, high caste, middle caste, lower caste, and outcast, right, that they were associated with color categories as well. So both the people in India had a color association with the highest caste, the Brahmins, were associated with the color of white, and the lowest caste was associated with color of black. That was not necessarily a racial or skin color associated, it had to do with the color symbolism. So in Europe, that division of the globe in terms of this major quote unquote races also got a color association by Linnaeus, the famous Swedish botanist who tried to systematize natural history in all the different species and subspecies and genii and so forth and so forth. And so he began to assign a color category to the four major varieties in the human species. And he referred to them as the Asian, Mongolian, right, was associated with color yellow. A European was associated with color white. The African was associated with color black. And American Indians were associated with color Rubens. Rubens is a Latin term for red or copperish red. So this is basically a classificatory system with color schemes superimposed on an artificial division between the varieties of the human species that is enormously complex. After Linnaeus, you got an idea of hierarchizing, making a hierarchy in terms of which was the best of those four, major four that Linnaeus had separated. And then you get, and Darren, of course, as a fellow anthropologist knows, is you get Blumenbach, the famous German physical anthropologist, the father of, he was also a medical doctor, and he ranks the four races, later were five, in terms of the highest and the second highest, third highest, fourth highest, and he linked that to the biblical theory of Adam and Eve and the book of Genesis. And so what you then get is that Adam was created perfect in the eyes of the Lord, and he was in essence cloned when God made him a helpmate, Eve, right, cloned from his rib. So Adam, made perfect, was marrying or had a mate in Eve. The question then was, what did Adam look like? And it became a big question in Europe. Where did he live and what did he look like? And Linnaeus was collecting skulls. And he at one point had a huge skull collection. He asked also for all kinds of people to bring him skulls from all over the globe. And he had measured that the most perfect skull would have been most clearly indicative of being the product of God's perfect creation. And that skull was found in the Caucasus Mountains in what is now called Georgia. It was a woman in her early 20s. He had her skull, he had measured it, and he said, this is the most perfect skull. So here you get the association of the European, quote, race, unquote, identified as Caucasian from the Caucasus Mountains, namely where that skull was found of this woman from Georgia, who in the eyes of this German medical doctor had the most perfect skull, and therefore indicative of the purest line from Adam. So everything else, if you belong to the human species, the greater the deviation from that perfection would be the result of degeneration. And the degeneration is a result of bad morals, bad sexual behavior, incest, bestiality, you name it, what it is. And so here you then get an explanation of the people who are most deviant from that European white model of perfection, most clearly articulated in terms of this woman from Georgia in the skull collection of Professor Blumenbach, that was the top. And the greater the deviation, the greater the inferiority. So the issue was not a great complexity for Europeans in terms of where to assign the blacks, because they were the most contrasting with the whites. Therefore, they came at the bottom and became the natural slaves for Europeans. Before all of this, Europeans were also enslaving Norwegians and Poles, and the word Slav, right? We still see it in the word Yugoslavia, Southern Slavia. The word slave comes from that. So it is only later that it becomes continentally identified, and particularly sub-Saharan. So
okay, Harold.
All of this mindset, just to wrap this up, sure. All of this mindset is part of the colonial perspective that Europeans are working out in the Western Hemisphere to categorize people in terms of their rights and their obligations, their place, their freedom, their lack of freedom, their rights to ownership of land or losing it.
Okay, that's a great detailed history of that blood quantum. Now, I want to, Morgan, I just want to take a sidestep away from that for a second. You wrote an article in Esquire, which I thought really, it was really well done. And it was about blood quantum. And maybe you could just tell us a bit of what you were thinking, you know, why you wrote the article, and then read us a little piece of that article.
Yeah, so I wrote the article because it was, you know, I had my novel coming out on June 4th, and they wanted to have it run like 2 weeks beforehand. An editor was interested in the idea, and I've always wanted to write about it. I mean, I wrote a whole book. I mean, a novel, you know, used it as the inciting incident, which gets the whole story going. And so I always felt like people don't quite understand, like, actually how strong of a thing it is, like how it can be weaponized in a way for tribes carefully, right? I mean, we talked last time, I think, of tribes that misused it and warped it, but I wanted to write it as kind of a condemnation against it, but also a condemnation against myself, you know, using it as like, I can take myself out of it, you know, I can pull myself away from the tribe if I want, but I have stayed in the tribe, you know, by using this system. And so I'm buying into the colonial construct of blood quantum that we've adopted, right? And I thought it was just a fascinating history, you know, trying to figure out where it came from. You know, Harold had given this huge, you know, talk about the various different places where there's are similar structures. And so really the foundation, though, I think had a lot to do with my son, Charlie, who isn't considered, you know, Penobscot because I'm a quarter blood and his mom is non-native. Just think about, you know, how I'll use language with him, how I'll tell him stories. And I mean, all he kind of does is scream and yell. So he doesn't really, you know, repeat anything back yet, but he will one day. I just want him to know that he is Penobscot, regardless of what a piece of paper says. You know, who knows? I could be 80 and then one day the Penobscot Nation raises the 50 or something, and then he's on the census. But like at the end of the day, I want people to know it doesn't matter unless you want your $600 like per capita check or, you know, but there are a lot of other things. Healthcare, for example, I wrote about that in the piece. You know, what if my son has, you know, the descendants have access to IHS until, what is it, 18 or 21, one of the two ages. And it's like, well, what if they're, you know, had been adopted out and, you know, they live with a family that doesn't really have the finances and their mental health is bad. And we think about the statistics surrounding Native Americans, and those statistics still apply to Indigenous people who are not on the census. And so if we have somebody getting health care through the tribe who's a descendant until they're 18 or 21, whatever it is, it's like, what do they do then? Is it main care? Like, I feel like there's just all these cracks that descendants can fall into if they're not, you know, in a family or a community that's, you know, supportive of them. And so I just wanted to, we don't need to be afraid of this thing. Like, because on the island, you say, you know, let's raise the census and like everybody stops working. But that's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to write something that was explosive in a way that people just don't talk about. I've not read a book that's really used it as the vehicle that's pushing the story forward. And so it's not that I feel like I paved something new. It's just that I feel like the art did it, you know, and that I just followed that weird policy we're under. And so I wrote the article, which promoted the book, but to educate people about what blood quantum is, because the book does not tell you what blood quantum is. The book requires you to, as one person said, it's not recliner reading. Like, you need to like work with the text. You need to get yourself out of the fictive dream, you know, which is a Western concept in a way, you know, and like, you have to think. This book demands that you meet it 3/4 of the way, I think, you know, depending on your novel, your level of knowledge, though.
Yeah. I think what you wrote in the Esquire article really came from deep inside your thinking and how you feel about this issue. So would you read me that first paragraph that from that Esquire article and title of the article?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll start with the title. The Treaty of 5:29 a.m., better known as the Treaty of I'll Show You My Indian If You Show Me Yours. It's April 2024. As I lift my 15-month-old son, Charlie, from his crib at the early hour of 5:29 a.m., I'm enveloped in thoughts, not just of our morning routine of changing his diaper and jammies, but the deep, defining reality shaping his future. I pick him up and in his ear whisper, Gwisses, the Penobscot word for little boy, my mother's term of endearment for me. Now passed to Charlie, the grandson she never met, weaving our language into his early memories. Kulsamul, I tell him. He smiles, his way of saying, I love you too, as we leave the room. Let's go make some coffee, I say, and Charlie and I descend the stairs. Mundane yet profound, these moments in the early morning are shadowed by what Mom would call a guguk, an evil spirit that will challenge Charlie's formal and legal connections to his indigeneity. Blood quantum. In the early mornings, it's as present in my mind as is my need for coffee.
Great. Darren, any comments?
Thanks for reading that, Morgan. It's a really touching and insightful article. And I think we spent a lot of time in the space last time kind of on the theories of like the blood quantum, and I think that one of the tensions that is in what Morgan just read and the rest of the piece and the whole structure around blood quantum, which is very much a colonial imaginary legacy. I think we talked about why we may or may not be using that as Indigenous people still to talk about ourselves. I think, to me, the underlying kind of tension in blood quantum, which is hard to understand if you're not used to the framings that, like, say, Harold used, or some of the things that are in Morgan's novel as well, in terms of the work needed, is on the one hand, colonial imaginaries have blood as something around identity, something around family, something around, it's very personal. And then in that, there is this sense of purity or impurity, even, you know, and a lot has happened in our election, but the idea that immigrants will poison the blood, right? This is a right-wing talking point always. On the other side of that is the identities that are being wrestled with in the sort of political and legal realm, which are, in its origins, were about citizenship, especially in the 18th century. So I think it's really hard to kind of disassociate the blood and nation references and how complicated that gets in settler nation states around citizenship, right? So it requires actually a kind of super logic of disconnection for people to come to this land. And eventually, through the creation of a settler nation state, tie citizenship to be
to being born in, so birthright citizenship, right, through the 14th Amendment, to have that as a basis for citizenship in a settler nation state during a period when the people who have been born there for thousands of years were not citizens, right? It requires a really particular rendering and racialization of the blood. And this is why our identities around blood quantum and race get so implicated in the frameworks of chattel slavery established through the United States, you know, its founding and continuation into the 19th century. So I think it's so hard to divorce those if it's about, you know, contamination of blood as a means to prevent citizenship, right, which is the one blood drop rule, or is it contamination of a citizenship or nationhood of gradual erasure, which is our embodiment as Indigenous people. Yeah, so I think it takes a lot of explaining, and it doesn't make sense. You know, if you're like, what's the logical model of this? Like, it doesn't adhere unless you can have both of those constructs in your head at the same time, a managing creation of a settler nation state through various forms of controlled citizenship statuses, and race as a factor around which it belonging or citizenship gets kind of constructed. So I think it's a very, and then when you pull it down to this sort of really intimate level of in the family kind of space, then that's probably the best place. And I think this is why your piece is so effective, Morgan, is that you don't have to explain a lot of that. You can show the tensions just in the intimacies of a family, you know, or the color of blood, or, right, you can kind of distill it into those intimacies to, and that's why I mentioned, you know, like a Linda Hogan novel last time, you know, Mean Spirit, or, you know, like often it is through these fiction and intimacies around family understandings that we as Indigenous people understand this like absurdist logic and yet feel very stuck with it. Whereas, you know, outsiders to it have come to it so naturalized because the ways in which citizenship and blood and race get construed in the American consciousness are natural. It's very natural. Like, you know, it's kind of like all the sort of forms of whistleblowing around, if you protest, if you're Black person and you protest in this way, you should lose your citizenship. Like, certain people's citizenships are so seemingly so contingent, you can lose it just in just, you know, these simple acts of love or protest as well. So yeah, I'm really fascinated by the fact that these contradictory structures get implicated in our identities, but also how we find our way through. And I think this is the not a literary critic, Morgan, but I think in terms of your novel, I think it's this, there's some hope of like re-indigenizing or reframing on our scale and our way, that is ever the hopeful possibility.
Harold?
In the last session that I was not present for, but your audience may have heard that, the concept of inherent sovereignty was used. And that's, of course, important because that deals with self-determination and self-government. And the question is, who defines who in terms of citizenship, in terms of identity? So all those issues come into force. But the key component that I miss in this discussion is the power of the state bureaucracy. And here we see not just an issue of identity or citizenship, but you see here a set of rules that are being imposed on the population at large, including internally colonized people, such as the people living on the tribal reservations, for example, or who are ousted from living on the tribal reservation. There's a set of rules that are imposed on, concocted by, invented for all kinds of reasons. And the question then is, why did, for example, the Spanish colonial regime in the course of the 17th century invent that very complicated structure, that hierarchical structure I mentioned earlier, of 16 different categories of racial mixing people in the colonized territories. And it had to do with rights and obligations, entitlements, what you could, how you could dress, whether you could carry a weapon, whether you not could carry a weapon, whether you could own land, whether you could take have a certain kind of job or not have a job. And you can see it in a very interesting, quick juxtaposition. What happened in Germany in 1933, Darren earlier mentioned implicitly a reference to the kind of times of peril that we now live in today here in America, where things are happening that I thought were impossible when I came back from Argentina, where I'd worked during the military junta. I came back to the United States and I saw the American flag and I said to my then girlfriend, that could never happen here, what I had experienced in Argentina. I would not be able to say that today. The country is in a very dangerous turn that reminds me of what happened in the 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s during the so-called Native American Party and the patriotic societies that were white supremacy patriotic societies that excluded not only women, obviously, but in particular, people of color and also Roman Catholics. So there was a very anti-Roman Catholic, Southern European, anti-Irish Catholic, anti-Eastern European. And today, of course, we see simply that discourse having shifted to anti-Latin American and anti-African and anti-Asian. It's the same basic fundamental principle. And so when we talk about identity, and I've mentioned Germany in 1933, the so-called Nuremberg laws were passed. And the irony is that the German Jewish population was the most assimilated, most successfully assimilated population in all of Europe. And they were the first targets for the extermination. And that happened on the basis of blood quantum, right? So if one of your grandparents was Jewish, right, quarter blood, right, you were deemed to be a Jew for the Nazi German state. And that meant, of course, A, first loss of your position, your job, and subsequently, of course, the vanishing in the gas chambers. And that happened gradually, but it happened gradually because the poison, and I think that Morgan referred to the word of a virus in your last discussion about this kind of thinking. It's like a virus. And here you see that the sickening of the German people, the Volk, happened because of this constant propaganda that we see today spewed out over the American nation, very powerfully enabled by an Australian-born Murdoch machine, and enforced by all kind of crazy people who have absolutely no idea about the consequences of their words, but they should be held accountable. They are not being held accountable because the media themselves are profit-making from any crazy scandal. Every crazy utterance is propagated by MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. All three of them are making huge profits of the craziness, but it's all craziness with a poison pill that sickens the American mind and therefore sickens American society. And ultimately, there will be a very high price to be paid by certain people in the population.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Harold. And, you know, you look back at the Cherokee and the Marshall decisions. And back then, I mean, the Cherokee did everything to assimilate that they could possibly think of. They had newspapers. They created a legislature. They created a government very much like the majority culture down there, and it didn't save them. I want to move on to Morgan's book, because I think Morgan's book, Fire Exit, that, you know, really looks at this blood quantum thing. It gives it, I think it gives it a human side. And I just want to refresh, well, actually not even refresh, but let the audience know about Morgan's book, Fire Exit. And there's a blurb here that I want to read. It's on Amazon, and it basically says, from the porch of his home, Charles Lemonsway has watched the life he might have had unfold across the river on Maine's Penobscot Reservation. He caught brief moments of his neighbor Elizabeth's life from the day she came home from the hospital to her early 20s. But there's something deeper and more dangerous than the river that divides him from her and the rest of the tribal community. It's the secret that Elizabeth is his daughter. a secret Charles is no longer willing to keep. Now it's been weeks since he's seen Elizabeth, and Charles is worried. As he attempts to hold on to and care for what he can, his home and property, his alcoholic and big-hearted friend Bobby, and his friend Louise, who is slipping deeper into dementia. He becomes increasingly haunted by his past, forced to confront a lost childhood on the reservation, a love affair cut short, and the death of his beloved stepfather, Frederick. Charles contends with questions he's long been afraid to ask. Is his secret about Elizabeth his to share? And would his daughter want to know the truth, even if it could cost her everything she's ever known? Morgan, I think that sort of brings out the humanity and the effect on families that this blood quantum requirement has. So, tell a little bit more about this book.
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the hardest things to talk about in general, at least in fiction, is identity. And, you know, for the best fiction for me, or what I consider fiction to ultimately be doing, is making the reader feel, you know, having that sense of empathy transported from, you know, the book to the person, and ultimately reaching a sense of transcendentalism, right? Where you're changed, where, you know, years later, you know, you don't forget this stuff, or this story, you know, it becomes almost like a memory, like it was a past life of yours. You know, that's the fiction I love, and I think the fiction everybody loves. But to write about that stuff, you need to imbue emotion into objects, just in a craft sense. When you're writing a novel or a short story, you know, specificity with literal concrete objects is very important. You know, when you read pieces and they're full of vague, you know, abstract thoughts and ideas, that's where you start to lose people. And so, you know, you read more academic stuff about identity than you actually do in fiction. Books will be marketed about, oh, it's about identity and about this and stuff. And I very rarely see the sense of identity, you know, coming out at all. As the days pass, I always get more critical of work I've published. I'm always like, I think this could have been better. You know, like this is how I am. So, but Blood Quantum is unique in that, you know, Harold, you mentioned that. And there are a number of different places that use kind of like similar things that had origins from colonial impositions, right? You know, to create structure and to take what they wanted. But Blood Quantum is the most unique thing there is in the world, as far as I know, in that it is actually a tangible object, right? Like Native people who are either on the census or not on the census, right? Like they're walking objects of a written law, you know, that defines who they are, despite their skin, despite the blood, all that stuff. And so I was thinking about it and I was like, that's how you do it. I was like, that's how you talk about the suffrage and or the whatever antonym you want to use to suffrage, right? Be it happiness or joy, right? To convey what it's like to be part or not be part of something in terms of blood quantum in Indian country. Because to talk about identity, I really think the only way we can talk about it in fiction, at least I can say, is through blood quantum in a tangible way. That's the only way we can make a reader feel, because there's no abstract idea. I can't remember who said it, but it's like, no ideas, but in things or something, right? It's like the objects are the things that carry the ideas. They're the things that convey the emotion. You know, I think of the term objective correlative in literary theory, which is when an object is imbued with or is presented and looks like the feeling of a character. So there's this poem by James Cruz, Telling My Father, and the boy comes home after a night, and, you know, he's a very sweet poem. And he waits a while before going inside. And, you know, he goes in and he's like, the poem reads, you know, and on the table sat, you know, a glass of orange juice in the sunlight, sweating. And so that, you know, object itself is a representation of how the character had felt. And you're like, you read that and you're like, oh, you know, like you feel it, you can empathize with it, you know, the tension, all of it, but the release of it as well. And so for me, I was much more concerned with the people in the book, right? Because I already had the inciting incident, you know, this is where we're going. This is where it is, you know, blood quantum. Like I use the term blood quantum maybe two or three times, you know, to give a little context, but I don't explain what it is. I didn't want to explain what it is, because to explain what it is to take away the power of giving the reader the experience of inhabiting what it's like to live under those circumstances. It, you know, pushes them away rather than just putting them actually in the reality. And so that was the hardest part for me. Well, no, that was the easiest part, because I didn't have to write like academic, you know, stuff that, you know, I rewrote this book so many times to get it right. But Fire Exit, and I did not say this. I've always had a feeling, but somebody said it to me who I trust very deeply. They're a great writer. I mean, they're a MacArthur Genius grantee, you know, person for literature. And they had said, you've given us a blueprint or something for the future. I just wanted people to know what it's like for people who have that similar experience that Charles has, because they're everywhere. They are. And they're in urban cities, you know, they're in Maine. You know, I went to school with kids who had to leave the reservation, who got better grades than I did in language class and Native studies, like I joked about last time on the podcast. But the book itself is just a journey. And it's fascinating to see actually the comments that people leave. I like reading comments. But on this one, a lot of people just don't get it, because I don't tell them. And I'm just like, well, too bad. You have to do some of the work here. I know you had a long day at work, all right, but you know, put in some effort, you know, a little bit. I mean, sure, art is subjective, but I think from a political standpoint, every story matters, despite how bad it might be, right? Or how bad it is like presented. And I'm neither going to say it's a good book or a bad book, you know, that's for people to decide. But for me, it was my attempt to try to make sense, to try to feel it, right? How I had felt it and how I know other people had felt it. It's a hard book to describe. I made my editor write the synopsis because I couldn't do it.
I think it's an excellent book, in my opinion. I think it's basically written for tribal people. Those are the people who will, when they read that, they'll get it.
There's a turning point in 2018 when Tommy Orange's book came out. There, because we had Sherman Alexie, or He Who Shall Not Be Named. You know, like the, you know, he was, you know, up here. And Tommy's book, Tommy's a great guy, you know, he's a phenomenal guy. He's, a dear friend. And Tommy came on and his work exploded. And people were like, oh my God, there's natives everywhere running hot. No. They're like, you know, that was the whole thing. It was an urban experience. And it opened up a pocket where he didn't monopolize on it. Tommy didn't do that. And it made space for these voices to pop up, you know, and to tell, you know, Fire Exit. And, you know, I don't think Night of the Living Res would have been as popular if that hadn't have happened, right? Starting then until now is like when there's so many native stories, I'd actually be interested to look at the statistics on how many have been published by houses since 2000 and, you know, or acquired since, you know, like 2015. Prior to then, right? I imagine it's a lot higher than it has been ever in the history, but more books are getting more attention, and deservedly so, because they're great books. They're telling stories that need to be told through the medium of fiction. And I just hope that one day the book can become an inspiration to change the way we look at citizenship, or membership, as the federal government says. I mean, because there's so much, you know, strength and opportunity in actually using blood quantum as a means to turn it towards the U.S. You know, it's not aimed at us. It's, I mean, we've been tricked into thinking it is, but really all we got to do is just take the metaphorical gun and turn it towards them, because it is, it's true. You know, if we increase, we can do whatever we want with it. I mean, we haven't been challenged in that way in the Supreme Court, you know, or there's nothing in place. Like, there's so many benefits to increasing population. Like, we can increase population, but then we could set stipulations where it's like, okay, everybody who's in now gets these things until we can figure out a way so everybody else can get it, right? So in the meantime, hang tight, but all of you can vote. All of you can do this, right? So there's a lot of evidence supporting the benefits of increasing tribal population, cultural preservation, political and legal strength, right? Economic development, community support, federal and state benefit, specific, you know, tribe to tribe, but, you know, a lot of them, you know, the Navajo Nation has been able to use their population size to leverage, you know, significant political gain, right? But again, each tribe is unique in its own history. I think tribes should all have like a task force that's dedicated to like looking into the ways in which their system of enrollment can be used in a way that is empowering us, right? Because it's like every weakness actually has a strength to it, I feel. And like, that's what we need to recognize. And so even though we look at it as this like thing we're stuck with, it's like, well, not really, because we can change it all we want. But then the possibility is like, well, then then Congress could be like, all right, we're going to use our little thing called plenary power, right? You ever heard of Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock, and they snap their fingers and poof, we're gone, you know? But who knows what the future looks like? But hopefully one day it's not like this. Hopefully one day it's not a man looking at his daughter across the river because he doesn't want to jeopardize her understanding of what it means to be Indigenous, which for many people hinges on being an enrolled member, which is an unfortunate ideology and way of thinking.
Darren, you have a comment?
Yeah, no, thanks for that, Morgan. And I think like a lot of things that are so heavily kind of contextualized through various forms of trauma, you know, I think, you know, trying to find that pathway for healing. And, you know, I think so much of that for us as Indigenous people is, you know, and this has been attempted, this isn't new. People have tried to return to older framings, clan identity, you know, to try to heal the disruptions of the colonial kind of order through our own traditions. I think always favor in that, because it also allows for a space of reconciliation or healing, you know, and to collectively say this is how we are managing our collective identity is ever traumatic, brings forth so many of these spaces that are scary. You know, I think, you know, it's a crisis of the imagination, vis-a-vis fear of change, vis-a-vis these traumas, right? That these are all kind of interconnected, that feels like we get stuck. So I really appreciate the idea that this is a moment where things like novels and fiction and, you know, and I think also just thinking about ceremony or healing, you know, like how we address that and honestly kind of pray in the space of this, like a collective trauma in blood quantum, and call it out. And even with people who are big supporters of it or who are afraid of changing things because of, you know, their fears are very real. I mentioned that last time, you know, fears of unknown people coming into our community and disrupting it. And, you know, that's happened, you know, I mean, it's not without, you know, the fear doesn't come from nowhere, but sort of like, how do we then, you know, make sure we minimize any of the harms and maximize, as you mentioned, Morgan, the kind of the strength that it would allow us for, and it is up to us. So I think, you know, to me, that's a real kind of profound kind of rendering or thought. I also think, like, you know, creating these dialogues around I was trying to work in one of Morgan's creations that I really like is he has an alter ego, Mr. Moose, that also writes book reviews. So reads book reviews, mostly of Morgan Talley's.
He's writing them now too.
Yeah. So I strongly encourage people to kind of reflect on Mr. Moose and how he's trying to work through reviews of Morgan's work and his reviews of other things. I guess he's more an expert in children's literature. Would you say that? Yeah, Morgan. Yeah, he has
a PhD though. He did. Okay. He doesn't have a PhD. He was incarcerated for a very long time, but he read so much that he has the knowledge base of somebody. Yeah, that's the.
So I think, you know, this is sort of a joke, although I do find Mr. Moose very amusing. But I think that represents to me, though, the need for a critical dialogue, honestly, like that we mobilize amongst each other. And I'm thinking about other, you know, pieces in our nation, you know, like where we're through, you know, James Francis and the Culture and Historic Preservation Department, you know, the ascription of traditional knowledge labels, having a community-based dialogue around pieces of our collective history or cultural patrimony, and having a, you know, really important dialogue around that to strengthen our future and what we pass on. So I'm, you know, ever kind of in favor of that in the most creative and flippant ways, as well as the most serious and sort of governmental ways. You know, I think using any of these tools would be really, really amazing. So I'm vaguely hopeful that there are generational changes that having this discussion, or people who have not yet had this discussion or been harmed by it in past generations, are going to bring this, you know, to the community in a good way. And it requires work. The problem is you can't presume, you know, full commitment of tribal citizens in a general council meeting or anything. Like, we really need to kind of go out and have focus groups and collectively kind of address things before we bring something to a general council. So I feel like we're really oriented towards that. So, I think my time is up. There's a really nice
if you could read that last bit from your Esquire article to the
It's April 2024. The shadows of blood quantum and invasive policies linger, frightening our right to define our identities on our own terms. It's no longer 5:31 a.m. but 5:32 a.m. The mundane yet profound morning is now unfolding. As Charlie grabs his stuffed kitty and drags it behind him, crawling back to me, the complexities of our situation become clearer. He is constrained by laws and perceptions he will eventually have to navigate. My deepest hope is that by the time he faces these challenges, we will have reshaped what it means to be Indigenous, not through the restrictive lens of blood quantum, but through the richness of our stories and the resilience of our continued presence. And I hope our people help him and all the others get there.
I want to thank our special guests, author Morgan Talte, Professor Darren Renko, and Professor Harold Prince for being on the show today. And thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles, from the CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and Joel Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.